Well, it has certainly been a busy first few weeks for the 45th President of the United States, with Donald Trump signing executive orders on everything from building that wall along the Mexican border, banning immigration, to blocking funding for health organisations who provide abortions around the globe. And there's growing speculation in the States that President Trump will soon make his presence felt in the humanities, with the elimination of the federal funding body there, the National Endowment for the Arts. Philip Kennicott is the art critic at the Washington Post, and he's speaking about that with Michael Cathcart.
What's the basis to these rumours, these reports that Trump plans to kill off the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts?
Well, at this point, it seems to be a budget proposal that Trump's people are circulating around Congress. But it has the ring of truth to it because the new administration is thinking of killing not just the National Endowment for the Arts, but also the National Endowment for the Humanities. And these are two organizations that conservatives in the Congress have long wanted to kill, so it would not be unlikely that this proposal would actually get the administration on the same page with some of its allies in the Congress.
What do they do, these organizations?
Well, first thing to know is these are very tiny organizations compared to other countries that have similar funding. The National Endowment for the Arts basically distributes money to state arts councils, and the state arts councils can do any number of things with it. But in general, what it does is it promotes access to the arts, and it puts its stamp, its imprimatur, on arts programs at the local level, and it works with local governments and other parts of the federal government to look for new ways to integrate the arts into everyday life.
Now, I've been looking at the budget here. The budget for the National Endowment for the Arts last year was $148 million, which is roughly the same budget that the Australia Council has, which does a similar job here in Australia. And that's for 14 times the population. The US is 14 times bigger than Australia. So as you say, it's a very small budget.
Right. And so two numbers to keep in mind here, $148 million for each of the two endowments out of a federal budget that's approaching $4 trillion. And then there are cities like New York City, which have their own citywide arts councils that are actually bigger or as big as the federal appropriation. So it's a very small amount of money.
So why are we worked up about this? It doesn't sound like it'll make much difference.
Well, there's both a long and a short-term history here. Both of the endowments are about 50 years old. They come out of the Johnson administration. And there has been a long-running conservative dislike of anything that gets the government in the business of potentially endorsing messages. But then there's also a longer American suspicion of the arts. It comes out of American pragmatism and also out of our Puritanism. So if you go back to the 1980s and the 1990s, there were a couple of grants that the NEA gave that went to artists who did things that were deemed obscene by some part of the population. And really, ever since then, they have been a target, a very popular target, that brought fiscal conservatives, who don't like the idea of paying money for these things, together with religious conservatives who looked at them as promoting messages that were un-American.
Let's bring in another voice here. We're joined by Katie Glenn Bass, who is Director of Free Expression Policy and Research at PEN America. Now, PEN promotes literary culture in the US and the rights of writers in the US and around the world. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make of this conservative hostility to the arts, the politicization of the arts? What do you think lies behind this?
Well, as Philip was saying, there's a long history here, and both of these endowments are favorite things for Republicans to zero in on when it comes to scoring political points with cultural conservatives and religious conservatives, as he was saying. But I will also say that there's an equally long history of once people dig in and really learn more about what these endowments do, there's an equally strong history of both of them being saved repeatedly under Republican administrations, because what happens is people start to take a look at what sorts of projects, really brilliant work, that both of these endowments fund, and they hear from their constituents, because so many of these projects are for state and local level arts councils, community theaters, things like that, and what happens is they end up getting saved. And at least two cases, there has been a congressional inquiry into both of these endowments, and in both cases, a bipartisan study group came back and said, you know what, actually, these are both really important, and they do great work, and as a result, they were kept.
What sort of work, Katie?
So the National Endowment for the Arts funds all sorts of state and local level initiatives for access to the arts, as Philip was saying, for communities that might not otherwise have so much access to culture. So it's about giving people more access to the rich cultural history of the United States. The NEA also, from the writer's perspective, the NEA gives individual grants for writers in support of literary and poet works. So sometimes this is the money that allows a writer to really finish their work, because as you know, writing is not such a lucrative profession, and these funds are what support that work and allow the writer to get their work out to a broader audience. And the NEH does a variety of support projects for scholarly work, for research, and particularly for archiving the United States' rich history and culture in a digital format so that more people can get access to it. So they are collecting, for example, the papers and the writings and speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, so that the scholars of today and tomorrow will have access to that rich body of work for their own production of knowledge that benefits everyone.
This idea that the arts favor the left, that the arts are radical in their politics, that it's kind of encoded into art, where do you think that comes from, Katie? And do you think there's any basis to it?
I think that where that comes from is the singling out of a minuscule number of projects that are funded by these endowments as a way to scapegoat the entire thing and score some political points. But I think if you look at the reason that these endowments were funded, as Philip said during the Johnson administration, it was out of the belief that great cultures and great democracies fund inquiry, they fund creativity, because it's part of our democracy and it benefits our democracy. We need informed, creative, curious citizens who have had a rigorous education that allows them to think creatively and analytically, and the humanities and the arts are what promote that. It's not a political bent. It's something that drives our shared quest for future knowledge, and it forms the basis of an informed democracy.
Philip, I saw the Book of Mormon, which has just opened in Melbourne on Friday, which I thought was marvellous. But I sat there gobsmacked thinking, so this is the kind of work that can come out of America. And it, for people who haven't seen it, it's wildly entertaining, but it's incredibly satirical in the way it represents the Mormon version of Christianity. There's a kind of electric Jesus who kind of lights up and on it goes. I suppose I reflected, Philip, that this suggested to me that the fundamental principles of free speech must be pretty robust in the US if this kind of work can have such a free reign.
I think you're right if you're looking at a musical that's had great commercial success. But where the endowments become critically important is funding things like documentaries, for example, at the NEH, that couldn't really find funding in other places. The marketplace is still a big, wide open, vibrant thing in America. And yes, we make lots of art that ruffles lots of feathers, and it has great success all around the world on a popular level. But really what the endowments are doing is a different kind of thing. They're funding kind of the last vestiges of free expression that hasn't been colonized by the larger market. And that gets increasingly difficult.
We keep hearing this idea that we've entered the post-truth era. What do you make of this idea that we can now talk any truth into becoming the new reality?
Well, that is something that I worry about a great deal, that if you take the cuts that are being proposed here, which include both of the endowments, but they also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And this is an organization that funds the equivalent of our national radio and our national television stations. And these are real bulwarks in a kind of big commercial sea of god-awful entertainment. They do really good work. They put documentaries on. They do some of the best news reporting out there. And one wonders if the larger goal is simply to kind of chip away at the public realm, to chip away at avenues of expression that aren't controlled and marketed by large corporations.
Katie?
Yeah, so I think that's also true. I think in terms of the question of fake news, there's a great deal being said and written about it right now, and I think we're in the early stages of understanding exactly what role it is playing in the American consciousness and American understanding. I do think that truth has a fair fight ahead of it, but I think that the evidence that fake news is dramatically swaying public opinion for a large number of Americans is still limited, which I say as a way to say there's still hope that we can push back against this tide and fight for truth and for the value of analysis and inquiry and debate. But it is a tough road. And it does mean that we need things, as Philip was saying, like these public institutions that are dedicated to promoting the idea of inquiry and also of impartial reporting and truth-telling.
Well, it also raises interesting questions about the role of fiction, because fiction has always played with truth, and suddenly the rules of fiction are kind of flooding out of the boundaries of the fiction section of the bookshop and taking over the store.
It's true. I mean, we also look to fiction in many cases to inform our reality and to give us the way forward. So I think writers are going to have a really important role to play in the coming years in the United States and around the world in terms of giving us the space to reflect and to think about the path forward.
Philip?
I mean, the difference, of course, with fiction versus something where there is an actual attempt to deceive is that fiction, we know from the minute we open the cover of the book that it's fiction. What we're dealing with now is something that seems to be circulating as truth, but really isn't. And so there's a level of deception that goes on between the two. And, you know, it becomes worrisome when people can't perceive that.
Well, you know, we've had 20 years of people telling us that in the postmodern universe, truth is just a social construct and that your truth is as valid as my truth. It does seem to me that we've come to a time where we have to say, no. There is such a thing as correct information and incorrect information. Of course, it still has to be interpreted. That's the postmodernist point. But you can either have your facts, your basic facts, right, or you can make them up.
It isn't accidental that when somebody like Kellyanne Conway, who's an advisor to the president, creates a term called alternative facts, that it has a familiar ring to us. It reminds us of, as you mentioned, a long debate about actually epistemology and truth that's been going on, mainly in the academic left. So it becomes a kind of amusing moment when many in the lefters are saying, actually, no, we need to talk about standards for truth, standards for veracity.
Mm. Well, once upon a time, the left believed that Marxism was a science, so people flip-flop on these things amazingly over the decades. Very interesting conversation. Thanks to both of you for joining me here this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Katie Glenn-Bass, who's Director of Free Expression Policy and Research at PEN America. And you also heard from Philip Kennicott, who's the Chief Art and Architecture Critic of The Washington Post. And I was speaking with Michael Cathcart. And that's it for the Best of Books and Arts this Saturday. Thank you so much for your company. Remember, you can always curate your very own Best of list by going along to our website or wherever you get your podcasts from and choose which stories and interviews from our very extensive back catalogue that you'd most like to hear. More books on RN tomorrow when Kate Evans brings you Books Plus at 2 p.m. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Enjoy the rest of your day with RN.